Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. For years, P.J. O'Rourke has trained his wit and critical eye on institutions ranging from the U.S. government, the global economy, to the automobile industry and American politics. In his new book, The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again, he trains his eye on his own generation. He leads readers on an expedition into the world of the boomer psyche. P.J. O'Rourke has written 16 books, including the bestsellers Parliament of Whores and Give War a Chance. He's also a regular panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. It's a great pleasure to welcome P.J. O'Rourke to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being here, sir. I appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome. A pleasure to be here.
It seems inevitable that at some point you were going to tackle this subject. Is that true?
I guess so, although I hadn't really thought about it all that much. And I was in actually pitching some other book idea to my publisher. My publisher, who is a younger member of the baby boom, said, "Do you realize that the youngest baby boomers are turning 50 in 2014, the generation that would never grow up, the generation that would be young forever, is turning 50. And I said, "Wow." And he said, "You got to write about that."
And here you are.
And here we are.
And it seems, though, in so much of what you have written about, and obviously in your life, that these are subjects that have come up because it is your generation.
Oh, yes. It is my generation. And we are a generation that's a very self-conscious generation. In fact, we are a very self-generation. If you take the word self and you put a hyphen after it, and then you can pretty much add anything else and describe the baby boom.
At what point did you become aware of kind of the cultural stereotype that is the baby boom and the baby boomer?
Well, I was, because I was part of I had a modest part, but nonetheless a part in forming that stereotype. I'm sure it was when I was at the National Lampoon.
Right.
I mean, we had a sense of being a generation apart during the 60s and the anti-war protests and so on. And yet that was part of a larger political context. We weren't particularly thinking of ourselves as an age cohort per se. But when we started to do the National Lampoon, when I went to work at the National Lampoon a couple years after it was founded, there was clearly a voice there of a particular post-Greatest Generation, the not-so-hot-so generation, if you will, that was very much in play and is evident in that old issues of that magazine, and becomes more evident when Animal House, the movie, is released. Two out of three of the writers were from the National Lampoon. And then, of course, Saturday Night Live, which was drew Michael O'Donoghue, one of the people who'd been right in at the beginning of founding the National Lampoon, was the first head writer on Saturday Night Live. So there's a trend. And a lot of the people, Gilda Radner and Chevy Chase, Bill Murray, had all been in National Lampoon productions, so there's a continuum there.
When it comes to growing up, I mean, this is what you talk about in the book a lot, which is growing up as a baby boomer and how this generation has aged, which is quite fascinating.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I found it to be a very interesting subject because I began to realize early on, besides sort of plumbing my own memory, I was doing some research on this, and I began to realize that the baby boom was probably the first generation in the history of the world to grow up in such comfortable, stable circumstances in one of the most powerful places in the world. I mean, maybe there was some generation during the Roman Empire that felt this way, but not that I know of. And one of the first things I found out was that as the baby boom was growing up in the 40s and the 50s, the 60s, really all the way from World War II until the Arab oil embargo, American economic growth is pretty much a straight upward slant. It's a steady economic growth. And I found out that our median family income, not our average family income, because that can be skewed by top and bottom, but the smack middle with half above and half below, was $10,000 a year higher than the median family income for members of the greatest generation had been. And that's inflation-adjusted dollars.
You write in the book, the baby boom would become the generation of current events. Highly aware, highly informed, highly involved. But like many baby boom characteristics, this was self-generated. How so?
Well, yes, I don't think we were particularly trained to be that way. There was always a certain amount of lip service in our educational system to being an involved citizen, which, you know, seemed to translate to come out to vote once every 4 years or something like that. But the baby boom really, it's been one of our characteristics to take everything personally. And so all current events have a personal resonance for us in a way that I think for other generations, especially prior generations, it was like, oh, that's happening far away to people who are nothing like us, and so what, you know? And that's not a baby boom attitude at all.
Just looking at the subtitle of, and it wasn't my fault, do you feel that it gets a bum rap and ultimately that really you were just, your generation was going along for a ride and it was inevitable that whatever generation took part after World War II, after the Great Depression, was going to be like this?
Well, yes, I think we were very much formed by circumstances. That circumstance of prosperity that I talked about, that not only had to do with a greater amount of money and a greater amount of economic growth, but when I looked back at the median family incomes in the greatest generation, I found that they went up and then they went down and then they went way up and then the Depression came and they went way down. So the greatest generation had also been subjected to volatility, economic volatility, obviously. And then, of course, it gets no more volatile than World War II, does it? So you have this extremely stable, this generation that grows up in a prosperous and stable America. America is kind of the last country standing after World War II. So there's no feeling of our being second best in any way. And so we were inevitably guinea pigs, and I think any group of guinea pigs subjected to this condition would have turned out to be, for good or for ill, the way that we turned out to be, which is a little selfish, a little spoiled, but also like deeply engaged and fundamentally kind-hearted, more than tolerant, embracing difference. This desire the baby boom has to give the world a hug and a drug. You know, I mean, it's we're a nice generation, not without our excesses, of course, but and fun. We also, I think, one of the big changes when the baby boom came along, which let's use the release of the movie Animal House as the marker moment there. Things have just been a lot more fun since the baby boom took over. I mean, Senator Blutarsky, right? I mean, look down in Washington. The city's full of them.
How are you aging? I mean, as a sense, as you talked about the younger end of the spectrum in the 50s, but as much of this generation is in the mid to upper 60s, is it becoming mellower and more understood, do you think?
Oh, I think so. You know, and funnily enough, I don't know about I can't speak for everybody, but I don't regret getting older. In fact, I'm amazed that I lived this long, for one thing. And I mean, we did the youth thing. We really did. We used up youth. I mean, we did all the youth things, and we did them with both hands. And we were excessive in our pleasure seeking, and it's amazing we made it this far. And all the stuff that we did, while it was fun to do, I don't think I'd want to do it over again.
Too tiring?
Too tiring, just too tiring. Well, it's, you know, it's like our version of the way the Greatest Generation felt about World War II. They were immensely proud to be involved in World War II, rightly proud of themselves. It was an extremely important part of their life. You know, if they lived through it without too much damage, you know, it was a huge point of pride. And, you know, all the veterans organizations attest to how important this was. But I don't think any of them would want to do it again.
Right. And another difference is that generation was less willing to talk about it in such detail.
Yeah, weren't they? They just kind of clammed up about this. And I think it was just because they'd been through enough. And what they wanted was a little breather, you know. And they didn't want to bring all this stuff back up again. My father-in-law is 88, you know, and you know, every now and then I'll get him to talk a little bit. But I knew him for years. He was my father-in-law for years before I found out. When he was a 19-year-old kid, draftee, fighting in Europe, and he was a forward artillery observer all the way through from like the Battle of the Bulge all the way to the Czechoslovakian border. And the average life expectancy of a forward artillery observer was about 20 minutes. You know?
Right.
And the only way it came up was one time we were talking about my kids wanted to go camping. He goes, camping. We spent a year outdoors in tents. I said, a year? And he said, yeah, we were never in a house because the roofs had all been blown off where we were. We were never in a building for a year. We slept in pup tents, winter, summer, spring and fall.
Wow.
He's not going camping.
PJ O'Rourke is our guest on the book show this week. The new book, The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again. You write in the book, the music we listened to was cool. The power of our generation is our music. It played a huge part.
It did, but the irony, of course, is that what is most closely identified with baby boom music, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the Who, weren't baby boomers. They were actually born in the 40s. In fact, a lot of that is true about the baby boom. We're thought of as this huge social catalyst. But in fact, if you go back to the 60s especially, you find that most of the people like Abbie Hoffman and Timothy Leary. And Timothy Leary was born in 1922. You know, Abbie Hoffman was born in 1936. Gloria Steinem was born around the same time. That the baby boom, we were not the team on the field. We were the tailgate party.
It came into its own eventually. You found your music and found your voice.
We found our voice. We definitely found our voice. And what we also did, of course, is this amazing authored this amazing industrial transformation into the e-world. I mean, that's our doing. I mean, we came along. Computers were the size of a house, you know, and mainly employed punch cards, you know. Baby boomers, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, both born in 1955, smack in the middle of the baby boom. And, of course, we older baby boomers remain rather confused about all this. My phone has got more apps than it could possibly need, you know, and I don't know what any of them do. But, you know, I'm always, you know, like trying to call a taxi and winding up with a pizza, et cetera. But it is, nonetheless, our generation that took this stuff and said, hey, we could make this personal. It's not for nothing that it's called a personal computer. That is the baby boom. Before us, they were highly impersonal.
You spoke about your father-in-law a moment ago, but you write in the book, we had already lost our sense of humor about our parents if we'd had one. Anything a parent said or did, we took personally.
There was an unusually bitter clash between the Greatest Generation and their children, the baby boomers, a kind of intergenerational clash that I don't see around my house. I don't see it between my friends and their kids. I don't see it with, you know, X, Y, and millennial generations. Of course, there are tensions, but not that clash. We felt we were creating a whole new world, and our parents were just absolute hopeless squares. And the funny thing about this is the more I looked into it, the more I realized that there were a lot of ideas, opinions, and feelings that the greatest generation had that because of their circumstances, economic and political, they had never acted on these feelings. And that a lot of what the baby boom got up to was acting upon the impulses of the greatest generation. And of course, naturally, that creates tension because it is quite angering to watch somebody doing what you have always wanted to do but never had the opportunity to or never been able to summon the nerve to do, you know, or feel you are too old to do. Nothing is more infuriating than seeing that.
You have a great line in the book. It wasn't like we hated the grown-ups, yet we were capable of real feelings for adults as long as they had nothing to do with our lives.
Yes, exactly. As long as it was like Jack and Jackie Kennedy, you know, we liked them just fine, you know. But when it came to mom and dad, boo, they took a lot of grief.
You know, in reading the book, one of the things that struck me about both good and bad, what is said about the baby boom, but my God, you went through such a tumultuous period of history. I mean, the assassination of a president, the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War. I mean, there was so much going on and so much that you were a part of. And it seems that it's silly to think that doesn't color and affect you in very deep, personal, and everlasting ways.
And one of the most important of things of those is the fall of the Berlin Wall, actually. And I kind of credit the baby boom with the fall of the Berlin Wall. People usually say, oh, it was Reagan and Gorbachev. But I think basically we were having so much fun on this side of the Berlin Wall. And, of course, the East Germans actually had access to West German television and radio. And so they knew how much fun we were having on our side of the wall. And I was in East Germany before, you know, that wall opened, and it was like going from a Technicolor movie to a black and white movie. I mean, it was terrible over there. And, you know, I think that, you know, the tension just built to the point where the East Germans finally said, enough with your workers' paradise, for Pete's sake, you know. We want to go to the disco. And that's really, I think, what caused that wall to crumble. And yeah, if you think about the whole sort of like political shift from, say, the mid 20th century to now, you know, the kind of like dominant, insane ideologies of fascism and communism and Nazism, you know, the sort of these big power struggles, the colonialism, all that's kind of gone, you know.
What do you think the lasting legacy will be of this generation?
Well, twofold. One good, one bad. I mean, it's definitely a nicer, kinder, happier, get-along, go-along world that we've left behind us. Maybe not in Iraq, but, you know, here, definitely.
Right.
On the other hand, simply the fact of our demographic bulge, the fact that there are 75 million of us, and that following us there is a kind of baby bust, leaving relatively few Generation X, Generation Y people to support all the entitlement programs that we are now taking advantage of as a generation, is going to leave a kind of resentment against us, even though we didn't invent those entitlement programs. I mean, that's FDR with Social Security, that's Lyndon Johnson with Medicare. But neither did we exercise the political will to straighten out those entitlement programs so that they wouldn't break the bank of the nation. And so I think we are going to be, at least in the short term, remembered for costing everybody a fortune. And it would be extremely surprising to me if there weren't some resentment about that.
And again, nothing that you really can do anything about as a generation.
Well, no. I mean, you know, I'm on Medicare, and you can't not be. I mean, like, you go down there and say, you know, well, you know, really, I just, you know, I would prefer to keep doing things the way I had been doing it. No, you know, you're on board, you know. And so Yes, but there are things, you know, the baby boom is of an age where we have tremendous political power. We have a huge voter turnout. We're at the top voter turnout age. The politicians in Washington by now are predominantly baby boomers. There are a few younger, there are a few older, but it's basically a baby boom political system. And so we could exercise the will to straighten out these entitlement programs. But, you know, given the fact that you know, adjustments to any kind of entitlement program are extremely politically painful, it might take a more courageous generation than us to, or a more desperate generation, either one, to actually get this thing fixed. You know?
You write toward the end of the book, there will be no suicide bombings. Baby boomers aren't going to strap explosive vests around our middles. It would make us look fat. There will be no genocide or ethnic cleansing. One thing about the coddling and cosseting and doting upon that goes into creating a generation of spoiled brats is that it leaves us with a sentimental streak. And this is a sentimental book.
You know, it is a sentimental book. I tried to keep it from being too sentimental. The whole time I was writing the book, I felt I was walking down the keel of an upturned canoe, you know, and if I stepped too far one way, I would slide down into sentimentality. And if I stepped too far the other way, you know, it would get all didactic, you know, and argumentative. And so I was trying to, you know, to evoke what happened and to reexamine what happened and also to plant seeds in other people's memory, or to use my own memory as a little bit of yeast in the dough of the memories of my fellow baby boomers, you know, to make this. So it's not so, but it does have a kind of fond affection for this. And I do think the world has turned out to be a better place for being run essentially by spoiled brats, you know. Spoiled brats have their drawbacks, you know, but being a spoiled brat doesn't make one evil, you know.
You have this wonderful way of balancing the satire and the celebration of both your generation and that time period.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Of course, it wasn't hard to satirize that, especially the 60s and the early 70s were pretty easy to make fun of, you know. But then there were certain things going on there that really were important, that had some throw weight to them, you know, that I felt shouldn't be ignored, you know. I mean, it wasn't all silliness.
When it comes to how you would like to see your remaining many years on this planet, what kind of impact do you want to have?
Well, you know, it's a typical baby boomer refusing to grow old. You know, I feel like I still have got a bunch of stuff to write. I mean, that's all I do. I just write. So, you know, I hope to be able to do a bunch more writing. You know, I'm not going to go back to, I spent a long time as a foreign correspondent, war correspondent, right, essentially, from the Civil War in Lebanon back in the early 80s through the Iraq War. I'm not going to go back and do that anymore. I'm too old to be scared stiff and too stiff to sleep on the ground. So that's, you know, that's over. But I do have, you know, other things that I want to tackle. And I think that, you know, I think one of the legacies of the baby boom, and I think it's a good legacy, is the idea that, you know, if people want to do something, they should go do it. They should go give it a try. You know, the worst that will happen is it doesn't quite work out. But you won't be 80 saying, oh, gosh, I wish I'd started that band. Oh, gosh, you know, I wish I'd painted that painting. Oh, gosh, you know, I wish I'd taken off and traveled around the world. But instead, you know, I got a job at Burger King. You know, we've kind of, I think, taught the world not that, you know, people aren't still getting jobs at Burger King, and not that there's anything wrong with that, but I think we have taught the world to follow their dreams, although you got to be careful which dream you follow, because a lot of people have, like, followed the dream of, like, leaving their spouse behind to raise the kids. That's not a good dream to follow.
No, not a good dream.
Yeah, not all dreams are good dreams, no.
PJ O'Rourke's latest is The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again. It's published by Atlantic Monthly Press. PJ O'Rourke, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very much for taking
the time. Oh, well, thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation, and, you know, it's just great to be on with you.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is The Baby Boom, published by Atlantic Monthly Press. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.